Our congregation engaged in a brainstorming session in January of this year to envision our future by maintaining our strengths and to become a more dynamic and larger extended family. On September 9th, the Strategic Planning Committee surveyed the congregation, resulting in the underscoring of the UUCF programming related to providing ethical direction, attitudinal direction, making friendships, personal growth, intellectual prowess, social justice, facilitated core, and music. The UUCF Board of Trustees is pleased to have Ken Brown, the UUA's Pacific Southwest District Executive, here today, and our goal to lead us, to transcend us into a purposely into the future, utilizing our strengths, addressing our weaknesses, and becoming a more dynamic UU present in this location in Southern California. Reverend Ken Brown will speak to us this morning about the theme of being together as an extended family at UUCF and the wider community with his sermon titled, Some Thanksgiving Thoughts on Bread and Community. Reverend Brown.
Boy, that's a lot to live up to here. It's good to be with you all. We do seem to have a theme, though, because along with Bill and John, Thanksgiving has sort of been my favorite holiday over the years as well. What do some of you remember about your first Thanksgiving? Just speak it out. We don't need the microphone. What's one or two words you'd use to describe Thanksgiving for yourself?
Too much to eat.
Family. Too much to eat. Okay. Food.
Grandmother.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, I suppose the answer depends on when and where you were born, too. I would probably answer football and family, or maybe something about the wonderful smells of the food. I grew up on the south shore of Boston, just north of Plymouth, Massachusetts, the home of that famous Plymouth Rock. Anybody else from that area? Okay, a couple of us, great. So for me, football meant not televised football, but local high school football, since the tradition was for the big rivalry to be played on Thanksgiving morning. So I'd walk the mile plus to the stadium for the game and then home again. And by the time I got home, my grandparents would be there, and the smells from my mother's kitchen were always enticing. And yes, this was the 1950s. It was my mother's kitchen. Of course, just living north of Plymouth, my Thanksgiving was also wrapped in stories about the Pilgrims and the Indians. From kindergarten on, in each year, we'd dress up as Pilgrims or Indians and reenact that first Thanksgiving, even in school. We made some of those dumb pilgrim hats out of paper. You know the ones that were about this tall, the ones that the real pilgrims never really wore. Then in 1957, I remember when the English made a replica of the Mayflower and sailed it over to Plymouth, Massachusetts. It was only upon seeing this ship that I realized the challenges that they must have faced in 1620. You see, the Mayflower, the ship that held 102 passengers, their worldly goods and stores, would probably fit inside this room. It was 160 feet from stem to stern and 25 feet wide. They sailed the Mayflower for 9 months. I don't know about you, but I get cabin fever after a few days with my wife and the animals around our house. And worst of all, the pilgrims arrived in the Americas in the winter. Wonderful planning. Yet on November 11, 1620, before they went ashore on Cape Cod, the male Mayflower passengers took time to make an arrangement and an agreement to join as a civil body politic. They also agreed the government, which would be chosen by common consent, and to obey all laws made for the common good of the colony. They knew that they would not survive unless they covenanted together in creating a community. William Bradford, one of the leaders who was very sick throughout that winter, wrote in his journal that in 2 or 3 months' time, half of their company died, especially in January and February. Being the depth of winter and wanting houses and other comforts, many died with scurvy and other diseases, which this long voyage and inaccommodative conditions had brought upon them. So as there died sometimes 2 or 3 a day. It wasn't until March 26 in 1621 that they actually had contact with the local native peoples. The pilgrims had earlier spotted the locals watching them, which caused them in February to ask Miles Standish to form a militia of sorts to be prepared. Yet on that day in March, Samoset walked into the pilgrims' camp, bidding them welcome, to their surprise, in English, which he had learned from the captains of the fishing villages off the coast of northern New England. And in April, he returned with Squanto, a name probably many of us know from our school days, who had earlier in his life been captured or kidnapped by the English sailors and brought to England, where he learned English. And on a return trip to his homeland, he escaped from the ship on which he was being held and returned to the Wampanoag tribe. These two men then introduced the pilgrims to their sachem, Massasoit. It's clear that without the help of the native peoples who generously shared their food and cultivating techniques, the pilgrims would not have made it through another winter. The first planting that the pilgrims nurtured through the summer with the native people's help proved to be one of bounty. In addition to the crops, they seemed to have gathered plenty of fish to store up for the winter, as well as waterfowl, wild turkeys, and venison. Governor Bradford wrote, "Every family had their portion." Thus, in spite of all the hardships they had gone through, losing family and friends to hard deaths, they decided to give the thanks to their God and to throw a big party. As Edward Winslow wrote in his journal, "Amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms. Many of the Indians came amongst us, and for 3 days we entertained and feasted." We've missed the boat. We only cut it down to 1 day. It's interesting to note that in that bash in 1621, there were only 5 women, one of whom was a servant, 23 children, and 24 men from the pilgrims, and of course an entourage of some 90 with Massasoit. Thus, through a rather convoluted history of various Thanksgiving celebrations, we now honor that 1621 event by recognizing Thanksgiving Day in this nation. The wonder of it all in that original Thanksgiving isn't that they celebrated for 3 days, or that the native peoples outnumbered the pilgrims 3 to 1, or even that competitive sports were clearly part of even the first celebration, although this latter point is important justification for the levels of football on Thanksgiving Day today. No wonder. The wonder of it is that they had survived at all. By spring of the first year, no family was left unmarred by the devastation of disease, despair, and death. Imagine, if you can, watching half the people you know and love perish because of the forces beyond your control. One can assume there must have been much suffering and sadness, and tempers were surely short, as there are a number of instances in Governor Bradford's journal where he discusses people being punished for fighting. There was even a duel where the combatants were only superficially wounded, but were then tied to the ground for a day as punishment. Modern-day psychologists could probably have a ball analyzing this group of pilgrims. I tremble just thinking of the anguishes that they were forced to survive. But the wonderful thing is they didn't lose their faith. What makes the first Thanksgiving so remarkable isn't the celebration that the pilgrims and the Wampanoag shared at the feast, but rather that the backdrop of grief and sorrow didn't block their reveille. What makes the harvest festival so noble is our remembering the profound depths of misery which preceded the pilgrims' decision to celebrate and to share with their neighbors. They chose gratitude over bitterness, generosity over greed, thanksgiving over self-pity. Kierkegaard once observed that it takes real courage to grieve, but it takes religious courage to rejoice. When my wife Tommy and I got married 44 years ago, one of our early disagreements was about that first Thanksgiving in the Americas. You see, she was born in Virginia, just down the road from Jamestown. So our good-natured ribbing of each other, of course, about which was the real first Thanksgiving, missed the point that giving thanks was a long-standing human religious tradition, even among the natives in this land. So who's to say when and where the first really was? It is, in fact, not that important. What is important is recognizing the human need to connect with our world and to be thankful for all we have. As John said, be thankful for every heartbeat. Be thankful just to be alive. Sadly, as we know, the good relationships between the Europeans and the indigenous people did not last, and eventually, believing they were under their God's guidance, the Europeans devastated the indigenous nations. But no matter what your thoughts on the origins of the original Thanksgiving Day celebrations, the lessons from the Thanksgiving of the pilgrims and the natives are important. That first lesson, which again you've heard from John this morning, is our need for community, our need for one another in order to survive. But the second, I think, is that when one group decides it has the truth, the way, that only tragedy follows. We have seen similar struggles in the recent election. We've seen the struggles right now in the Mideast. Think about where else these lessons might ring true in your life. Are there places where losing sight of the vitality of coming together hurts a group of people or a community? One place I believe we need to remind ourselves of these lessons is in our Unitarian Universalist congregations. As we go through transitions and change, we need to remember that we come together in a covenant to support each other, to support each other on our individual faith journeys. This doesn't mean that we can't disagree, but it does mean is we need to keep the eye on why we really create these religious communities, the congregations that we come to as Unitarian Universalists. As John shared in the communion of the bread, we come as a diverse lot, but by coming together, we create a wonderful community. We learn from each other. We share the depths of our own experiences with each other. This is what is at the core of who we are. Yet, I have to tell you, in my role as district executive, there are times that I experience us as our own worst enemies. At times, we can be very rigid. We can believe that our version of Unitarian Universalism is the correct one, or we argue with the authority we give to the board or our minister in our representative form of democracy. We do need to remind ourselves why we gather in our congregations. So as we gather in Thanksgiving, that Thanksgiving is for our communities we create and a remembrance of the reason why we create them. I travel across the Pacific Southwest District, probably 40 to 50,000 miles a year, because I believe deeply that our Unitarian Universalist religious communities are needed now more than ever. We are too small, though, and have too important a message to always be arguing with each other. The world needs us and our saving message. We need to come together as the pilgrims and the indigenous people did in the early years and support our diverse communities. We need to choose gratitude, generosity, and thanksgiving. Let us remember the traditions of thanksgiving that go back to the beginning of time and be thankful for what we do have. Let us remember the bread we shared and its symbol of our coming together in the community. The future calls us to sustain our open and diverse religious communities. As we move into the future, we need to follow what many of the indigenous nations do in any of their actions that they take, to look at the impact of any action taken today on 7 generations out. Can we do no less? Do we not have a responsibility not only to ourselves and those sitting next to us in the pews, but to the future generations of Unitarian Universalists? The choices we make to create such communities is in our hands. Be thankful for that opportunity, and happy Thanksgiving.